evening, everyone, and we move on. We move on tonight to the second section of the Seven Habits. It's a new part of the Seven Habits we've been talking about. Because as we explained last week, the three habits, the first three are more about the type of person that you are, the type of person that we choose to be, the plan, the aim, the vision, and we refer to that as independence. And today we move into interdependence, where we use the first three habits to then relate to other people, to enhance our relationships, to make them more effective, and to apply them, particularly in areas where there could be difference or conflict. So just to review very quickly, first three habits, the first one was being proactive, where we acknowledge that in our personal journey, we are the ones that are responsible, we make decisions, we decide how to respond to various situations and experiences in life. The second habit was the habit of direction, leadership, begin with the end in mind, where we have the goal, where we have to choose the right wall to put the ladder on, we read from the right map to get to our destination. And it was about creating the center. If you remember, it was talking about creating an ethical center, creating a center of our lives based on ethics and values rather than being people-centered. And the third one was the habit of management, actually applying it effectively, managing our time, particularly in those four quadrants, remembering that the most important quadrant is the second one, important but not urgent. Those are where all the things that are in line with our vision, with our goal, normally get put, and we normally put them off. And we don't give them enough time, and the trick was to steal from that, from the other quadrants to actually build up quadrant two and give it more emphasis and spend more time on it. So today, as I said, we take these three habits then and we move into habit number four, five, and six. Just to give you a quick preview, the four, five, and six are really connected. The fourth habit is called think win-win, which we're going to develop soon. The second one is, the fifth one is seek to understand, then be understood. It's the habit of communication. And then the sixth one, is synergy, which is called creative cooperation, where we look for alternative solutions in cases of conflict or dispute that was better than the original suggestion. It's all synergy. It's creative cooperation. We'll talk about that next week. We'll get sort of looking for better solutions, alternative creative solutions to a problem. Okay, so let's develop this. We know that as we've mentioned before, the basis of human existence is relationships. Everything that we experience in life involves some form of relationship. Friends, parents, children, children, parents, spouse. Even our spiritual journey ultimately is a relationship between us and God. And the completion, the perfection of a human being is achieved through effective relationships. Right? That was the way the world was created. It was the design in such a way where the person is incomplete. The completion, the perfection of the human experience, the human function is achieved through effective relationships. However, without sounding morbid, the rule is like this. But we'll develop it and you'll see what I mean in a minute. The perfection and the completion and the realization of the potential of a human being can only take place with relationships where there is some level of conflict or challenge. Difference or sometimes even dispute. Right? Conflict, challenge, difference and dispute in relationships is not a bad thing. It's inevitable. In fact, not only is it inevitable, but you actually cannot achieve the perfection of the human being that is achieved through relationships unless there is that level of tension or level of conflict. In other words, the aim is not to get rid of difference or conflict. The aim is to learn how to manage that conflict. Okay? You know that when Adam was created in the Torah, God said, it is not good for Adam to be alone. I'm going to make him a partner. The term for partner in the Torah, I'll put it there in Hebrew, is Ezer Kenegdo. Ezer Kenegdo means I'm going to make him a support Kenegdo that will stand opposite him. Meaning that will be different to him. That will look at things completely in a different way than he does. Hence, male and female, right? Where different perspectives that will create differences, that will create Kenegdo, will create almost like a challenge in a way, a dispute in a way, or conflict in a way, on some level, and that will be the support for Adam. That will be the way that they both realize the potential and the perfection of the human being. We find another Talmudic source, an interesting source, where before God gives the Jewish people the Torah, which of course is a tool of growth, Moses goes up to Mount Sinai. It says Moses went up to heaven. And in heaven he encountered angels, lots of angels. That's what the Talmud tells us. It's a Midrash. And the angels wanted to know, what's this guy, what's this human being doing here? So God said, he's come to get the Torah. Right, that's the plan for the human being to get the Torah, to bring it down back to earth. So the angels turn to God, it says in the Midrash, and says, don't give it to him, give it to us. You're going to give away the Torah, your treasure, give it to the angels, we'll do better with it, we'll understand it deeper, we're more spiritual, we'll connect with the Torah in a much greater way than the human beings will give it to us. So it says that God turns to Moses and he says, whoops, you got a bit of a problem here. You better come up with a good defense. Hire a lawyer, you know. You gotta... I was just for Jonathan. You gotta come up with a good argument. So Moses turns to angels and says, okay, I'll represent myself, it's okay. He says, let's deal with this, he says. What does it say in the Torah? It says, do not steal, do not commit adultery. He says, tell me, you guys have a yetzer hara, do you have an evil inclination? Are you challenged to do the wrong thing? So they said, no, you know. It says, the Torah talks about resolving dispute between human beings. Do you have disputes? Do you guys have jealousy? Do you have lust? Do you have all the negative traits that human beings have? Do you have all the challenges that the human beings have? You don't have it, the Torah is not for you. So of course the question is, what kind of answer is that? If they don't have an evil inclination, so then for sure they'll keep the Torah a lot better than we do. Us guys fail a lot of the time because we have an evil inclination, because we have challenges. They don't have a challenge, they won't fail. At least they'll treat the Torah a lot better than we do, perhaps. But the answer is in the argument of Moses. The Torah is a tool of growth. The purpose of giving the Torah is that people should realize their greatness, their uniqueness, which cannot be completely realized unless there's challenge. Unless there's a yetzer hara, unless there's evil inclination, unless a person is challenged, unless there's opportunity for failure, unless there's inner conflict and conflict between people, unless there's a difference, the Torah is worth it. It's not worth giving it to them. Why? Because what happens is like this. When a person is challenged, and this is a general rule of life, not only in relationships, but it particularly comes into relationships. When a person is challenged, it requires a person to explore new opportunities. In other words, if everything goes smooth, if everything runs according to plan, then you're very trapped. When things run according to plan, there's no need to explore deeper solutions. There's no need to explore more creative alternative ways to solve problems. There's no need to dig deeper within the soul and to discover or reveal more hidden strengths. It is specifically the area of challenge that pushes a person to break his or her boundaries, that pushes a person to grow in a deeper way, that pushes a person to look for a deeper solution. Without challenge, it can't happen. The whole purpose of existence, the whole purpose of a human being is to grow. The whole purpose of a human being is to reveal that unique concept of a human being that we spoke about the first week, that to change, that we can really change, we can become different. You can't do that without challenge. And in relationships, it's the same way. Because if there's no difference in relationship, if there's no almost I know conflict is a strong word, but if there's no difference of opinion, or different perspectives, or even conflict in the relationship, then the relationship stays smooth, but at quite a shallow level. It never gets a depth. When there is conflict, and you manage it properly, properly means you look for alternative ways, you look for a different perspective, you explore a whole new world, you understand something new, someone new, a different perspective, a different concept, a different path, a different solution, a different strategy. You've discovered new concepts, you've discovered new strengths, deeper strengths. And it makes a much better human being. Now, of course, this is only possible once we've done the first three habits, because in order to do that, you need to be a strong person. A person needs to be a strong individual, a strong human being, and that's all. In other words, before you can manage a conflict properly, you need to know who you are. Because don't forget, the relationship means that there's two people who both have a strong identity. And the purpose when we talk about resolving a conflict or looking for new and deep and alternative strategies, it's not about dissolving my identity. It's not about disappearing. I have an identity. I have a strong identity. I have a view. I have a vision. I have a goal. I have a direction, which is established by the first three habits. Once I have that and I've built in that inner strength, then I can go on and go even deeper, where I'm able to then apply that and implement that even in areas of conflict, where I can use my strength and my vision to explore deeper strengths. And that's why conflict is so important. Yeah.
So what's the consequence if the one individual hasn't developed the first three as well as the other?
Yeah, very, very good. Very good question. It's always a question that comes up when we deal with relationships, right? And we talk about strategies. It's always a problem. What happened? Relationships are a two-way street. Okay. And therefore, the strategies, the effective strategies that we talk about in relationship, with regard to effective relationships, normally has to be something that both parts of the relationships explore or take upon themselves. And that's a problem. Because if one is locked, then the other can implement any strategy they want, it won't help. However, as we said the first week, very often, or more often than not, when the one party of the relationship does it effectively, it normally makes it a lot easier for the other one to become untrapped. It's the principle we spoke about in the first week, that when you concentrate on your circle of influence, then the circle of concern becomes smaller. Right? So therefore, normally when we have a conflict, and a conflict, when we get stuck in a conflict, means people are trapped. As we'll soon see in a few moments, whichever one tries to exacerbate their conflict, everyone becomes more and more trapped. However, even if one of the people unlock themselves and start to apply good strategy, very often that softens the other and lets them unlock themselves as well. It doesn't always happen, and sometimes relationships have to come to an end. But it makes it a lot more, much, much, much easier. Yeah.
Isn't it true that Judaism kind of promotes the idea that peace, shalom, is better, is greater than, say, you know, your particular gender, or that you should sort of, you know, like the ways of peace, the even truth, so to speak, peace is being true to yourself.
Yeah. But let's understand what peace is, you see. Peace doesn't mean true peace. You know, it says the Torah was given to make peace in the world, right? And there's a famous concept that the Torah was given in the third month, not in the first month, right? True peace means not that we dissolve our identity. That's not peace, right? That's a relationship of abuse, of control. When one consumes the other, then there's no identity, there's only one person. That's not a true relationship. True relationship means that there are different perspectives, there are different points of view, to the point where sometimes there's potential conflict, and it's managed so that both points of views can learn to coexist and come up with something even better that incorporate both things, which is what we'll achieve by going through these three habits. Sincere. Okay, so let's talk about conflict. In a relationship, in any relationship, when there's a difference of opinion, or there's a conflict or a dispute, there's three things that happen. Okay. There's position, there's the goal, and then there's the underlying goal. What do I mean? Unfortunately, normally, the dispute lives in the position. And that's the problem. We need to shift the dispute from the level of position to the level of goal. Let me give you an example of a real story. Yeah, that's right. But it becomes a lot easier when you do it through the first three habits of becoming a better human being. And then so it's not a manipulation exercise.
A collaborative negotiation.
Oh, no, sure.
It's about not taking positional.
Absolutely. By moving away from the position, correct.
Look at joint goals.
Correct. So I'll tell you a real story. I'm going to change the facts a little bit and not tell you where it happened, but it's a real story. It's a story that can happen anytime, any place. Probably does happen more than once. It's a school. Because the story is a simplistic story, but it brings out the point really strongly. So you have a kid in school, a high school kid that misbehaves, talks to a teacher disrespectfully, whatever the case is, right? Gets sent to the principal. The principal disciplines the child and says, listen, I have no choice, but this Sunday, you're going to have to sit at detention. Gives him a detention note, child goes home. Principal gets a call from the father. This Sunday, 10 o'clock in the morning, my son's not sitting in detention. You can jump in the lake. My son plays sport. Sport is very good for him. It's good for his self-esteem. He's got final competition. It's coming Sunday. He's got to attend the thing. He's not coming to any detention. Of course, the principal gets a call like that. Can you imagine when the principal explodes? If he doesn't show up to detention, I'm going to suspend him. We'll have in-school suspension. It comes like an unbelievable conflict. Right? So there's a position. Let's understand the position. The position of the principal is that the kid must come to the detention. So this detention, this Sunday morning. The position of the father is the kid is not coming to the detention. Right? Each one gets more and more. At the level of position, there's no resolution. The positions are totally in conflict. There's no way you can resolve it. Normally what happens is that's where the conflict lives. That's where the conflict explodes. That's where the conflict is developed and nurtured. And it just gets worse and worse. Because on the level of position, it's impossible to resolve a conflict because the positions are totally different. But then there's the goal. And the goal is that the child should come to a detention. It doesn't have to be Sunday morning, 10 o'clock. But they need to come to a detention. And then there's the underlying goal. And the underlying goal is the overall welfare of the education of the child. The benefit of the child. What's good for the child. Right? So let's analyze what normally happens. Unfortunately, we'll come back to this in a second. Unfortunately, there's a script that people normally work with. And that script is called the script of competition. Society has trained us to work with the script of competition. There's many, many reasons for this. Society defines people and how they compare to other people. Success is defined how it compares to others. You know, it's my continuous gripe with the school system. When does a kid get a prize in prize giving in a school? When they do better than other kids. You ever thought about this? It's absolutely bizarre.
Instead of doing the best.
It doesn't make any sense. I'll show you the maths. So you have a kid in year 8, a kid in year 9, right? So a kid in the 1 year gets 95%. Did brilliantly, worked really hard to get there, but doesn't get the prize. Why? Because some genius of a kid gets 99%. Right? And the next year, another kid gets 90%, didn't work very hard, cruised because he had a good brain, could have done better, but comes top of the class because it happens to be a very low achieving class, comes with honors, he gets the prize. It's absolutely bizarre, doesn't make any sense. There's got to be a better way to do it, but that's the way they keep on doing it. And that's the values we instill in children at very, very young ages. And it's a terrible thing because what happens is it feeds into the whole general modern day, very, very secular sort of view that success is defined by how it matches up to other people. And people start to then think that their own success is how it compares to other people. What they have, it all depends compared to other people. So to be successful, you have to have more than other people. And all this unhealthy competition stuff develops at a very, very unhealthy level, right? So generally, people are wired to work off a script of competition. And what happens when people work off a script of competition? When they enter into a conflict, because of that, we're so imbued with this competition mentality. So what happens is that the competition is implemented in one of three ways, all in the spirit of competition. It's either win-lose. That's what Stephen Covey refers to as win-lose. Lose-win or lose-lose. Right? What do I mean? So either because you have to define yourself, your success, by winning, therefore it's a win-lose. I'm not going to win, let you win, so therefore I'm going to win. And therefore I'm going to implement every tactic. I'm going to use every strategy that there is to win this argument. If it means manipulating you, bullying you, cursing you out, forcing you, whatever I'm going to do. But I have to win. Because we're working off a script of competition. Right? So therefore, person will do everything they can to win this conflict. Even if they have to steep down to very, very low down strategies. So they can be stronger. But they won't move away from their position. Because if I move away from my position, that means I'm losing. And I don't want to lose the argument. Therefore, I'm going to stay strong in my position and move you away from your position with any strategy I can. If that doesn't work, what some people do is they work the other way around. It's also a consequence of the competition mentality. They become so insecure, they give up completely, they see they can't win the argument. If they can't win, so it becomes a reverse sort of mentality, and they move into lose-win mentality. All right, I give in, I always give in, you always do this to me, you know, my sister used to do it to me when I grew up, you're doing it to me now, I know this is going to be my lot in life. You know, the martyr kind of thing, you know what I'm saying? I'm always the schmatter, I'm always the, you know, I'm always the one that has to give in. So it becomes a lose-win mentality. But again, it's a very competition mentality. Right? It's, I don't win, so I'm just going to lose like a hero. You know, I'm going to lose completely. Like, right? I'm going to lose all the way. Like, if I'm going to lose already, it's going to be, wow, I'm going to lose like lose properly. Unfortunately, there's a third position that we do find a lot of times, and that's lose-lose. You know, when I was a kid, I'll never, certain things stick in your mind. I'll never forget one day a teacher told us this concept. And the concept was about the shtetl mentality. So he's telling us, like this, you know that in the shtetl, in the old Jewish Talmud, so he described the following two following scenarios. He says, interesting thing, he says, you know that in order to have chicken for Shabbos, so people would, you didn't go to a butcher, what you used to do is you would go to a, you go buy a chicken, first of all, live chicken. Then you would take a live chicken to a shochet, or a certain person knows that I slaughtered the chicken, and they would do it. Then they would take it home and kasher it and open it up and salt it and cook it for Shabbos. That's the way it was done. Right? Now, today the butcher does it all for us, so we're not even familiar with this stuff. But in those days, every sort of housewife knew how to do this. So they would open up the chicken. What happens? You open up the chicken, sometimes there's a halachic question. For example, one of the bones is broken or bruised or... And there's a problem, halachic problem with the chicken, because there's a lot more to a kosher chicken than just then ritually slaughtering it. There could be other problems. So what do they used to do if a woman would open up a chicken and find a problem? They'd take the chicken to the town rabbi, right? And the rabbi would examine the chicken. Yeah, and there's all kinds of, I mean, this is done today also. Just today it's done in the abattoir because it's done mass production. But that's why it was done in olden times. A rabbi of a town needed to be very, very well versed in the halachot of kashrut. The laws of kashrut on that level, even to know what, all the intricacies of the biology of a chicken. And you look at the chicken, you say it's good. There's no, this kind of thing is okay. Certain things would render the chicken trash. What would happen if after real looking into it, the rabbi turns to the woman and says, look, I'm really sorry, this chicken is not kosher. Right? So the truth is it would be a calamity because there were certain people that used to wait a whole week. They couldn't afford meat or chicken during the week. And this would be a big chunk out of their weekly salary. And that was it. They lost the chicken. So it was a loss of money and then nothing they can do. Right? So what would they do? They were devout, pious people. They'd give a krecht and they'd say, go home and say, okay, what can we do? So next Shabbos we'll have chicken. He says, interesting thing, same type of person has a dispute with a friend, a conflict with a friend, over an amount of money that's worth less than the chicken. But have a conflict. What do you do? You have a conflict? In olden times, you go to the rabbi, like a base thing, right? And you figure it out. So the rabbi listens to both sides. This one says he owes me the $10. One doesn't owe me the $10. They have this conflict. They go. And the rabbi says, I'm sorry, your friend is right. That's what used to happen. The guy gets so upset. Come out of the rabbi. This rabbi doesn't know what he's talking about. he favored the other guy, it exploded, it was unfair, the guy lied, where's the justice? You say, what's the difference? What's the difference? The guy shows up with the rabbi, and the rabbi says the chicken is not kosher, and he accepts his fate, accepts, okay, not kosher, so I lost the $50, what should I do next week? And there he has a conflict with a person, and he loses $10, and he explodes. The difference is very simple. If I lose the chicken, I lose the chicken. But if I lose the $10 so that you should win the $10, no, that's not going to happen. Right? The competition script. And therefore, sometimes people will fight to such a low level, and the conflict will derail to such a low level, where if I'm not going to have it, you're not going to have it either. It's a lose-lose mentality. Because if I can't win, you're not going to win either. Stephen Covey writes a most bizarre story. I'll just read it to you because I hope that's not a common story. But he says he knows of a divorce where a husband was directed by the judge to sell the assets and turn over half the proceeds to his ex-wife. In compliance, he sold a car worth over $10,000 for $50 and gave $25 to his wife. You see anything like that? When the wife protested, the court clerk checked on the situation and discovered that the husband was proceeding in the same manner systematically throughout all his assets. Okay, that's an extreme example of a complete nutcase, but that's the mentality. It's a lose-lose mentality. It's no problem. You're not going to have it. I'm not going to have it either. If I'm not going to have it, you're not going to have it. So nothing. Yeah, it's amazing. However, when we master the first three habits, right, and we understand the goal of our existence, we understand the ability to be proactive and to make choices, we understand and appreciate the opportunity that exists in differences in relationships, to dig deeper, to discover a different perspective, right? To act on and to find something that's got to do with sort of a common goal. Right? What we're able to do, if we have the strength to do that, is to move away from the competition script. And to move away from the competition script means to move into a whole different mentality, which Stephen Covey refers to as the win-win mentality. Right? The win-win mentality. The mentality where everyone wins. To develop a new mindset where everyone can win. Now it takes an amazing, it sounds so simple, but it takes an amazing strength of character. I'll tell you a beautiful little story with one of the Hasidic rabbis called the Belzer Rav. It was a very great tzaddik in Galicia. Belzerov had the following practice. He would receive people every few times a week. People would line up long, long lines, blocks away, to come and seek his counsel, seek his blessing, have a word with him, ask him for something small. And he had the following system. He would sit in a big room behind a table, and he had an attendant, someone who would run his affairs. And there was a door at the end of the room. And what used to happen is they would open the door, and then people would file in and form a long line until the Rebbe would put up his hand, and then they would close the door. And then one by one, everyone who was in the room would approach the table, talk to him, go out the other door, and when the room was empty, the whole process would repeat itself. One time, the Belzerov was doing this, and everyone was filing in the door. And he picked up his hand, and as the attendant was about to close the door, one guy snuck in. Snuck in when he wasn't supposed to. Right. The Belzerov saw this. So as this guy got to the table, the Belzerov said to him, "Did you sneak in when you weren't supposed to?" So you have to admit, you can't tell the rabbi lies. So he said, "Yeah, I did." He said, "Okay, I want you to go to the end of the whole line." So the guy was so devastated, like, "Now it's going to be a whole other way." Right? So he goes to the end of the line. 3 minutes later, the rabbi tells the attendant, "Go and call that guy and tell him to come back." So he calls him back, he talks to him, he asks him a blessing or advice, whatever the case is. And then the Rebbe turns to him and he says like this, he says, "You're probably wondering why I sent you to the end of the line and then why I called you back, like one way or another, you know." So he said it, in Yiddish it sounds a lot better, but I'll try and translate it better. He said like this. He said, "I sent you to the end of the line so you should learn at the dafnish uisfirim, which means you can't always win. You don't have to always get your way. But then I called you back because I want you to know that I also cannot always get my way. So we both have to learn that. So you have to know you can't get your way, I have to know I can't get my way, And that was the best way to do it. Right? It takes an amazing strength of character for a person to realize that moving away from their position doesn't weaken them as a person. See, the problem is that sometimes we are insecure, and therefore, because of our insecurity, we become so locked in our position. Because we think that if I move away from my position one iota, it's a sign of weakness. Where in fact, we know that the opposite is true. In our mind, we know the opposite is true, but we just emotionally don't always know it, right? That courage to move away from our ego, to put our ego a little bit to the side and say, I'm prepared to move away from my position, is an internal strength. You see, if my whole identity comes from competition, if my existence is one of comparison to other people, then if I show weakness in my position, then I'm showing I'm weaker than you. But if my identity is internal, if my identity is built up by the strength of character, by my principle center, you see, if my center is principle-based, not people-based, which we spoke about in habit 2, if I know that I have the ability to make choices notwithstanding my disposition to be locked into my position, if I know how to implement it properly, then in fact we know that it's a tremendous strength of character from internally, from inside, to actually say, I'm big enough and strong enough to explore an alternative solution here and to move away from my position and to start thinking about principles and goals and values. It's a strength. We think it's a weakness, it looks like a weakness, but actually it's a courageous, brave step to be able to take. Right? And let's go back to that example. What is the goal? The goal is that the child to do a detention. Not that he should do detention at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, that's the position, not the goal. The goal is should be a consequence of behavior. What's the underlying goal? Right? What's the underlying goal? The underlying goal is that this child should be educated. Imagine if a principal will get a call that goes something like this. It's a very simplistic example, but just it brings other points along. Imagine if the principal will get a call that goes something like this. The father calls the principal and says, listen, I'm really sorry about what my son did today. I understand that he misbehaved, and I fully support you that the school needs to give him a consequence and he has to get detention. However, I have a matter to discuss with you. This child is acting out because he's got a general problem with his self-esteem. One of the things I've done is I've allowed him to play sport on Sunday because I think it's very good for it's building him up and he's feeling better about himself. And in no way I want to compromise. We both want the education of the child. We're both on the same team. Can we negotiate a way where he can play his finals and he can still sit his consequence? What would the principal do if you heard that? Of course he would agree. Right? Because and then both of them would be moving away from their position.
Ask a question. Let's presume all of us in this room are fairly enlightened and we want to go out and win. But we know in this world when we come up against many people that don't take that attitude and have a win-loss. And I mean, the reason I said earlier on about this is negotiation 101 is because you're always trained as a negotiator. You start with win-win in your mind. That's the most effective way. That's game theory. But what do you do when you come up against a person who you've taken that approach and the principal doctor says no? Is it acceptable to move to a win-lose position then and a competitive bargaining style in accordance with what Kobe says, or do you have to be the compromiser and lose yourself to let them win? What do you do?
Okay, so it's a similar question we had before in a way, but first of all, two things. There's two answers to that question. Sometimes Stephen Covey says like this, that it's not always win-win. What it is, what can happen is, it's win-win or no deal. What he means by that is, it never is good to live in the world of competition. It's not good to develop as a human being for that. Right? So sometimes we can reach a win-win, and sometimes we have to agree to disagree.
But what happens when you can't?
So sometimes relationships have to come to an end. Now, of course, there's choices to make, so then the father will have to make a choice. In my opinion, if that would happen, the principal would be totally wrong. The father would have a choice. Either he'd move his kid to a different... So then the father has to think differently. He has to think, okay, what am I going to do now? What's best for the child? Again, it doesn't mean that the father cannot move away from his position. He could. Because either the father could do one of two things now. Either he can fight a tooth and nail, bring it to the city council, I don't know, alert the newspaper and the radio and the talkback shows, right? Or, but that's not necessarily good for the child. So the father has to think to himself, okay, I'm not winning here, but what's my goal? Not what my position is, what's my goal? My goal is the best for the child. So then I'm going to have to choose between the best of two evils. I know it's important for my child to play that game, but is it worth it for him to know that I'm not supporting the school? So I've got a choice. If I think the school is being that ridiculous, I've got to move schools. If not, I'm going to have to swallow it and somehow sell it to my child, but I have to support the school because that's the best interest of the child. Right?
So you're saying it's better to compromise than to compete back.
Compete back doesn't work because compete back just increases everyone's position, increases animosity, and in the long run is detrimental for everyone's development. So sometimes, yes, that's why I'm saying no deal or just compromise or give up. Rather, but compromise in a way where, again, you're not compromising out of a weakness. It's not a lose-win thing. Right? It has to be out of strength. In other words, it would have to be a decision that you make because you're moving away from position thinking about the goal. However, having said that,
I accept that in the long run, it's not a sustainable position. Win-win is the only long-term sustainable way to maintain.
See, what's gonna become clear in a minute is like this, that there's a strategy to ensure that it's a two-way win-win. And that's the next habit, really. Because if you do win-win properly, as we'll soon talk about, the chances are that the person will unlock. Not only you, it will be a two-way.
But let's just say you're a father and you kind of realize that that's the solution. You'll have to do detention at a different time. That's the one you want to get. So quite possibly you could have the initial gambit, if you like, which would be, no, he's not doing it. And then the principal kind of, then he's the one that proposes the solution. And
could be.
And when he proposes it, it's like he came up with a great idea. And he owns it.
That's a competitive.
But you see, number one, number two, I mean, it doesn't matter who comes up with the solution, right? It doesn't matter who's in the win-win mentality. The chances are whoever shifts the mindset to the win-win mindset has a better chance of getting the other one to be win-win. You're right, if it was a very, very clever principal, and the father called up and just let it loose like that, the principal would say, I understand, now let me just think it through, let me talk it through with you, and he would try and bring the person around. Okay, you're right. But normally that doesn't happen. Normally one person starts with a position, the other person comes back with a position, and the positions intensify. As soon as one person breaks that cycle and starts to shift into a different mode and leaves the competition script and starts to think win-win, it normally has an effect on the other, particularly when we'll see the next habit. So, when we talk about this habit, just before we go to the next habit, the habit concept here is more about developing the mindset. Because the skill here is not actually to get the win-win, because you need the next, because these three habits work together. Here the habit is simply, whenever there's a dispute, whenever there's a difference, to think it through in your mind. To actually think it through, let me try and shift mindset. Let me leave the competition script. The initial reaction of every dispute is position. That's the initial reaction.
So the habit is really get away.
The habit is move away from that position. Right? Let's just start thinking about the goal so that we can enter into a win-win. How do you actually do it? The way it's actually done is by going to the next habit. And really it's the habit of communication. And it's the habit which says, both parts of this habit are very important, by the way. Seek to understand and then be understood. And let's try and develop this problem. First of all, just a general concept about relationships before we go on to this habit. Stephen Covey makes a very, very important point. That although all relationships will have conflict, and as we've just talked about, particularly from a Jewish perspective, how that's so important, and how you can turn conflict into an opportunity to be more creative and deepen the relationship and deepen the understanding and reveal a greater character strength. But nevertheless, he talks about the concept of an emotional bank account. The concept of an emotional bank account is this. When you do hit conflict, it'll make it a lot easier to use these strategies if there's been an emotional bank account of trust, respect, and loyalty, and all these other wonderful things built up in the past. In other words, it doesn't just dealing with conflict and resolving conflict and managing conflict, right, doesn't just happen in a vacuum. When two people begin a relationship, there are a lot of relationship strategies that need to be put in place while the relationship is going well before you get to the level of difference, before you get to the conflict. Things like bonding, things like trusting, things like sharing, things like respecting. Right? And the more that happens, the more you're able to draw upon and to get into win-win mentality and to understand and to be understood when these type of conflicts do happen. So I think the rule is this, that some level of conflict is bound to happen in every relationship, and it's a good thing. But we need to prepare for it. And prepare for it means we start long before that happens, and that is that there has to be the basic respect and love and bonding and loyalty and trust and all those other things that nurture relationship. Relationships have to be nurtured. You cannot just start using strategy once a conflict comes. Every relationship, work relationships, parent-child relationships, all these relationships have to be nurtured, and when they're nurtured in a strong way, then when there's conflict, it's much easier to put all these strategies into place. So let's understand the strategy of probably the hardest strategy, but the most critical one in human relationships, and that is seek to understand and net to be understood. So Stephen Covey has a wonderful analogy, and he says like this. You go to an optometrist for a bit of help, right? So he listens to your complaints, you're not seeing properly, you can't read properly. So he takes off his glasses, his own glasses, says, you know, these, I have a spare pair, says, these work very well for me, put them on, they'll be okay. So he put them on and he can't see a thing, right? He says, what's wrong? He says, I don't know, I can't see. He says, why not? They work for me, why don't they work for you? Right? So he says, I'm trying, but I can't see. So what's the optometrist going to say to you? Try harder? Think positive? Mm-hmm. Have a positive attitude? You got the wrong glasses. That's a very simple analogy, but a very important one. Because when you have a conversation with someone, particularly when you have a difference of opinion with someone, we have to learn first to understand them. Understand them means to see the world the way they see it, not the way we see it. Right? And that naturally is not the way most people listen to other people. Right? Most of us, when we listen to other people talk, we do not listen with the intention of understanding. We listen with the intention of replying. Right? You know what I mean? Like you listen to someone and while they're talking, you're formulating a response.
And you can see other people doing that.
Yeah.
It's very easy to recognize.
Absolutely. Right? Sometimes it's very obvious. They're just waiting for a small window where you catch a breath so they can get, you know. As soon as someone starts talking, they say, but they're polite, so they wait for you to finish talking. But really, they're not interested in what you've got to say. They really have it all already. Just they're waiting for a bit of an in so they can get into it. And that's useless. Because when you reply to someone without first having truly understood the way they see the world, it's like the optometrist giving them your glasses. It's got no use. What's the use of replying to someone and giving them a point of view where the point of view doesn't fit into the way they see the world? Right? One of the most basic needs, apparently, of a person is to be understood. Why? Because as long as a person is not understood, they feel judged. And they become defensive. In a conflict and a difference of opinion with someone, if a person doesn't feel they're being understood, they feel insecure, and their natural instinct is to become defensive or to fight back, to protect their point of view. Sometimes the most basic need what a person needs is he just needs to be understood. He needs to know that you really understand where they're coming from. There's a little passage in called The Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot, that says, Al tadin es chavercha, do not judge your friend until you have reached his place, which means until you can truly see the world from his vantage point, from his point of view, then you cannot judge them at all, because you need to see it from where they're coming from. Right? If we want to really, really resolve a conflict, if you want to really move into win-win situation, if you want to really not just become unlocked, this goes to the question you're asking, if you want to really make sure that it's a two-way street, that not only do we unlock ourselves from our position, but we get the other person to unlock themselves from their position, You want it to be a two-way thing. You want the other person to soften just as we are softening. The first thing we need to do is to really understand where they're coming from. Not to think we understand. Yes, I know what you're saying, but. Right? I know what you're going to tell me, but. First step is we really need to truly, truly understand where they're coming from. Extremely difficult. It is the most. Right. You don't. Yeah. As I said, it's the most difficult to have it. Right. I'm going to develop it a bit. Yeah, go on. Saying you don't understand is better than saying correct. Yeah. It's better than saying you understand when you don't. correct. Right? It's better to be honest and say, I'm trying to see your point of view, but actually I'm battling. Much better than actually saying, yeah, of course I know what you're talking about. I know exactly how you feel. When you don't. And they know you don't. Because people have antennas. They know, they can feel that you don't. Yeah, sure. You see, now we're talking about in situations of conflict where you can't just listen because eventually you've got to come up with a response. Right? But step one is to really listen. I want to share with you something interesting. The world is created in four parts, we are told. There are four creations. There is the inanimate objects, like soil and minerals and things like that. Then there's the tzomeach, the vegetation. Right? This comes from the Talmud, the Medrash, etc. Then there's the chai, the living things. Then there's the human being. In Jewish sources, the human being is called medaber, the speaker, the communicator. In other words, communication is at the very essence of human function, the ability to communicate properly. And yet, there was one of the great sages in the Ethics of the Fathers that said the following. He said, I think it was Shimon HaTzadik, maybe someone else. He says, I've grown up all my life among the sages, he says, and I've never found anything better than silence. Silence, to be quiet. So always used to battle with this. It's a strange thing. Here we are, we get called the communicator. It's the uniqueness of the human being to communicate. We are supposed to be the one who is able to communicate. And he says the best thing is to be quiet. Doesn't make sense. Until I reflect on the whole concept of communication and I discovered that this is the point. So what he meant was, it didn't mean that you never talk. Communication is essential. We have to communicate with people. We have to share our feelings with other people. That's the only way we bond with other people. That's the only way we can have relationships, is by effective communication. But what he was teaching us is that the first step to communication is the communication of silence, which is the communication of listening. True listening. Silent listening. Effective listening, where you really, really listen to the point where you understand the other person. You see, very often when we listen to people, you can even judge by the way we respond, right? Like we'll probe, so we'll say, so what's the matter? What's bothering you? Okay, that's not too bad. We'll evaluate, right? We'll interpret. We'll advise. Right? We'll do that when we listen. A kid comes back to school, they're upset. The teacher was really upset with me today. What happened? Oh, so the teacher punished you. Oh, so you must be misbehaving, right? No, it's not misbehaving. I wasn't just being picked on. It was someone else, a friend. You just got to stick it out. Just stick it out. Total non-listening. We do this with kids. We do this with adults. We probe. We evaluate. We interpret. We advise. What are we doing? We're totally remaining in our own world. And we're communicating totally from our point of view. Right? Totally ineffective. You can never get to a win-win situation if you do that. Because win-win situation means that you have to go to something deeper. You have to really understand the other person. You have to understand what's the goal. Where's the person coming from? How's he seeing the world? How am I seeing the world? Now let's see if we can come to something better. Right. To really, yeah. Sure. I think that's what I think. I don't think he meant necessarily to be absolutely silent. I think it meant the silence was that you shut yourself down. I'm going to talk about that in a second. Sometimes to really listen, you do have to ask questions. And sometimes you have to repeat and you have to play back and things like that. But the silence aspect of it is this. It's what Stephen Covey refers to as emphatic listening, empathy. What does that mean? Real listening means like this. And this is why it's so hard, as you mentioned before. Real listening, and I'll tell you even more why it's so difficult. Real listening means to totally shut down. That for those few minutes where that person speaks, where you're listening to their position or their point of view or their side of the argument, that you're able to totally shut down and say, for right now, my views are cancelled. I'm clean. Totally on the side. Let me completely try and see the world from the way that person sees the world. You know why it's so hard? Number one, it's very hard because it means giving up our ego completely for those few minutes. Right? The second reason it's so hard is because it's risky. You know why? You know what's such a risk? If I truly listen to you and I truly see the world from your point of view, although the goal is not that I have to agree with you necessarily, by the way. I have to understand you. I don't have to agree with you. But the chances are that I will agree with you. The chances are that if I see the world from the way you see the world, I might actually come around. I might actually have to leave my position. I might actually have to give up. And I see that as a sign of weakness, as an insecurity. That's a hard thing to do. From my point of view, from where I stand, when I'm heated up and I've got a point of view and I'm very passionate about the way I see it, for me to totally shut down and to take the risk that I might actually see it your way is a risky thing to do. It's an incredibly strong thing to do. It's an incredibly courageous thing to do. It's an incredibly unique thing to do. It's a strength of character. It's a depth. But it could happen. And we have to be prepared for it. Because if we're not prepared for it to happen, it means we're not really listening. No, because I might see it your way, and I might all of a sudden understand that to reach the goal, actually, I don't need my position at all. But actually, your position is just as effective to reach the goal, I might see. I might actually discover that we're just arguing, we're not even arguing about the goal, we're arguing on the positions, and my position is irrelevant if I see it your way. Now, I didn't say that's the goal, because the habit says, and this is very important, again, a relationship does not mean when one side dissolves, right? So the habit says, seek to understand and then to be understood. You see, if I really try, if I'm the only one who went to the course and I'm having a dispute with someone and I want them to come around the way I'm seeing it, it's a two-stage thing. I need to really listen so I completely understand where they're coming from, and then once I've softened them and they feel understood, once they really feel understood, then I can ask them to do the same for me, but not before. Because I have to soften them up first. I have to unlock them first. And to do that, I have to really understand them and then say, now I want you to really understand me. And then let's see what we can do about it.
But isn't that manipulation?
No, it's a reasonable expectation. I'm not doing it for manipulative purposes. So I really do understand you. But I still don't agree with you. So now I really want you to understand me. I'm not saying that you have to agree with me. Just like I don't have to agree with you, I don't want you to agree with me. But I want you to understand me. Because I have a need to be understood just like you have a need to be understood. So I'm not trying to manipulate your point of view. I'm asking you to understand me. Once we both feel understood, then we're going to go to habit six, which is synergy, and we're going to try and come up with creative solutions.
And is that explicitly stated?
It could be. It could be. After the person feels really understood. You can say, and by the way, sometimes you confirm the understanding by mimicking back. Like you mimic what the person is saying, you reflect what the person is saying, you ask questions. So does that mean? You explore their feelings. So when the teacher did that to you, how did you feel? Did you feel that? Right? Did you feel you were being picked on? How did it feel? Did it feel really bad? Did you feel like you were out? Did you feel like you were being, you know? You try to get into their feelings and answer the questions. So you do ask questions. Right. Yeah, of course you ask questions, but it's questions of silence. I mean, it's questions of really listening. It's a different type of question. A As you said before, it's the most difficult thing to do this, but it's the most important. Because naturally, none of us do this. None of us really listen. It's even more than active listening. It's deeper than active listening. It's emphatic listening. It's really getting into the other person's world. I tell a story. I'll take this in a second. I tell a story of one of the Chabad Rebbe. It's called the Mittler Rebbe. Great little story. And he was sitting all night, and people were coming to see him. And he had an attendant who was helping him. He wasn't a very smart person. Cleverest of people. Anyway, after the whole night, after the Mittler Rebbe had seen, I don't know, 50, 100 people, he was sitting in the chair completely exhausted, and he was perspiring, he was schwitzing, he was like finished, as if he'd been doing rigorous sport. Right? So this attendant, who wasn't the smartest guy, says to the Rebbe, he says, "You didn't work hard physically, you sat in your chair, pretty comfortable chair, you were sitting all night, why are you so tired? Like what? Why are you schwitzing like that?" So Mittler Rebbe said, "I'll tell you why." He said, "You know, in mysticism, in Kabbalah, the means of expression on how we express ourselves, thought, speech, and action, is referred to in the Kabbalistic teachings as garments, levushim. Just like a garment is the way a person expresses themselves, so too we express ourselves through the garments of thought, speech, and action." He says, "You know, when people come and see me, I have to figuratively undress," he says. "Because in order to listen to the question, I've got to get dressed in their garments, in their clothing. Otherwise, I don't understand the question. So when a person comes and sees me, the first thing I have to do is I have to completely undress myself, so to speak, from my clothes, figuratively speaking, and get dressed in their clothing. But then once I've fully understood the question, they came to me to ask advice. So I've got to then undress and get back into my clothing and think about the solution in my world. And then I've got to relate the answer back to their world. So I've got to get back into their clothes." He says, you try getting dressed and undressed the whole night like that and see if you'll be tired of that, right?" You know, I once saw this. I mean, I've seen this many times, but I once just witnessed a very interesting thing. I was in Israel, and I went with a cousin of mine to see a Hasidic Rebbe in Yerushalayim. Today his name is the Amshanov Rebbe. And he's a very interesting individual, very, very great learned person. He's very spiritual. But he has some very interesting practices. He's got some very weird time management strategies. What I mean is he does things like he can come out for the Torah reading sometimes like 2 a.m. in the morning or something like that. So we went there. It was after a Shavuot Brachas. We were laid up late. We went to see, you know, in Israel, anything goes. So it was like 2, 3 in the morning, Thursday morning, and he came out. He was doing like a service, a Torah reading service. And that was an opportunity. The custom was that people came over to him to ask him questions. So, he would stand. He was standing in one place. Everyone was standing quite a distance, and people going over to him like one by one to ask him questions. So you could see the conversation, but you couldn't hear it. So privacy was protected, but you could see him converse. I very rarely seen someone listen like that. Like you saw him listening to the question of the people, like you could watch it, like it was totally immersed in the person. So much so that one fellow. He's a very learned person. He's a very clever person. He answers, he gives people advice. There was one person that he heard the question. He could see he was intently listening. When the person finished the question, instead of giving the answer, he suddenly stopped and he closed his eyes for like 3 minutes. And he opened up his eyes and he gave him an answer. He gave him an answer. I don't know what the question was. I don't know what the answer was. But what had happened, it was quite clear to watch what was happening. When he was listening to the question, okay, certain questions were more simple, so he had an immediate answer. But when he was listening to the question, he wasn't thinking about the answer. He was totally thinking about the person asking the question. And when it was a complex question, by the time the question was finished, he didn't have an answer yet. Because up until the person had finished asking the question, he was totally in that person's world. So he had to then leave the person, go back into his world to discover the answer, and then communicate it back. It was amazing. I remember it just touched me then. It was just an amazing thing to watch. And that's real listening. And if we the fourth habit was to develop a mindset of win-win, to move away from our position. But then if you want to actually do that, the way to begin doing that is to seek to understand, to really understand another person, to leave ourselves go, to let ourselves completely on the side, to let our ego go, to shut down our views, our world, our existence, and to actually listen and try and really understand the other person. It is, as we said before, it is so hard. It is so hard, particularly because sometimes, you know, we all know people that say things that are totally bizarre, right? From our point of view, that is. They're totally idiotic. You think, you know, you hear it says, like, what are you smoking today? I mean, what are you on? Like, what do you mean, right? But as bizarre as it might be, and in fact, it might even be bizarre, but it's not bizarre to that person. Otherwise, they wouldn't have said it. No one says anything intentionally stupid or wrong or evil. If someone says it's because from their point of view, they know what they're talking about. And therefore, sometimes what we do is we listen to something that is so ridiculous, so the more ridiculous it is, the more we want to shoot it down immediately. And the more it's ineffective. Because until we understand where that person is coming from, so to leave ourselves and to understand the bizarre, ridiculous world of the other person, but to really understand it. And the chances are, if it's truly ridiculous, we won't agree with them at the end, but at least we'll understand it. If we understand it, we have a much better chance of resolving that conflict and understanding it. So once we can do that, you see, that's why these second set of habits are based on the first three. Because to really do this properly, you have to internally be a strong human being. And that strength of character is based on values. And that strength of character is based on not comparing ourselves to other people, about being principle-centered rather than people-centered. Having the ability to make a choice against our disposition, to have the strength of character to make those choices. That's why these habits can really only work if we have the first three habits. They have to work together. Once we do that, and we shift our minds to win-win, and we really seek to understand, then we can go to the sixth habit, which is to find a creative solution. It's called synergy, which we'll talk about, please God, next week, which will also be the final week where we do the sixth habit, and then the seventh habit wraps it all together. Have a great night. Any questions?